stuff.
Pardon me?
I sent you some stuff. Did you get it?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Appreciate it very much. Some of my questions will be coming from that.
It was interesting. The guy that did that thing, that writer,
mm-hmm.
he used to write. He was a sports writer in New York, and he was telling me that he was out to Yankee Stadium the day that Gehrig made his talk.
Oh, yeah?
And I said to him, I said, yeah, I remember what his words when he said, today I consider myself to be the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Well, he didn't hardly say it like that. He said, Lou had the New York accent. Today I consider myself, you know, how New York is talking. But he said it was quite a moving thing. You know?
I bet it was.
All right, take off.
Well, interesting thing about this fellow that interviewed you before, his name is Krause, I don't know how to pronounce it. This interview we're doing will appear in a magazine published by Krause Publications. It's spelled the same way. I don't know if there's any connection or not.
Well, now, Bob's retired. He used to work with Nationwide Insurance Company I worked for.
Uh-huh.
And then he does some freelance writing. I know that. I don't know. So he would probably be somewhere in Columbus, Ohio, or in that area, I'd say.
No, this place is out of Wisconsin.
Oh, is it?
Well, that's near the end of there.
Okay.
Okay, in the minors, you had no trouble with the pitching. You had in 5.5 years, you had 129 home runs, and you had a .299 batting average. You pretty much overmatched them everywhere you were. When you went to the Giants, your batting average went down. What happened?
Well, there's as much difference between AAA and the majors as there is between Class D and AAA. In the minors, you know, you play a four-game series, you get two good pitchers, two mediocre pitchers in a four-game series, and maybe one decent reliever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the majors, you know, they're throwing good stuff at you all the time. You know, you play a four-game series, you're going to get three pretty good pitchers and a decent pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And probably now the reliever is even more prevalent than it was when I played, but there's some decent relievers in. I mean, you take Elroy Face and Hoyt Wilhelm and Marv Grissom and some of these people, Clem Labine, and
mm-hmm.
they were pretty good too. You know?
Yeah, they were. Labine especially, if you... he was used just whatever the Dodgers happened to need, they used him.
He could freeze you right at the plate. That curveball was so vicious, that sucker just freeze you, you know.
He'd probably be a one-inning pitcher today.
Yeah, probably, and he'd be a good one-inning pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you came up mid-'55, you took over at first base, and your power figures really didn't change at all, so evidently they didn't cut down on your ability to hit the ball a long way.
Well, what they did, and it's just like the American League, they got behind 2-0, 3-1, here comes a fastball. And you warp that thing, you know, because I was a fastball hitter, dead fastball hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you hit a few home runs and... you know, you're really under a microscope. That's the reason that they talk about the sophomore jinx. The first year, you can have a pretty good year your first year because they don't know you. You go around the league at least twice before they really get a book on you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've got the pitchers that are not pitching are in the dugout watching you hit. Now they're videotaping the hitter. Then when you go around the league... pitchers be talking to pitchers from other teams, and they say, boy, that Harris is wearing me out. And the guy said, well, all you got to do is keep that fastball in tight on him and then throw him a break and stuff, and he won't bother you. So then they get the book on you. And, you know, they're at Detroit in 58. Why, they get behind me 2-0, 3-1. Here come a fastball. Hit 20 home runs, drove in 83 runs.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next year, when 2-0, 3-1, they come in with off-speed stuff and this and that. And not that I couldn't hit it, but I'd just kill every worm in the infield hitting that thing to second base. Hit it hard, you know, but in all the time I played against Nellie Fox, I don't think I ever got a ground ball by him. Hell, he everywhere I'd hit the ball, he'd be there. I'd hit it in the hole, he was there. I'd hit it behind second, he was there. Little sucker was a magician, so... You know, they pitch you a certain way, they play you a certain way.
Well, that's what they're supposed to be doing at that level, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Well, when you came back to the Giants, you had sophomore jinx, really jinxed it. You came back, you were in the lineup only part of the time, but when you look at the numbers compared to you and anybody else they put at first base that year, you numbers, and then what they call, I guess, the regular. You had more home runs, you had more runs batted in, you had a higher batting average. Why couldn't you get in there on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I don't know. It's, I guess, probably inconsistency, you know. Then the Giants, they had Lockman. Whitey had played first base a lot, and so they sort of platooned us. I think Drosher told me, he said, every play I've never seen, son, you showed me. So maybe that's one reason, one reason I didn't play.
That's funny.
I'll never forget that. I know I hit my first home run there in the Polo Grounds off of Lou Burdette and put us ahead of the Braves, and I was feeling pretty good. You know, I'd only played a few games with them, and I could just see the headlines, New York paper, you know, rookie's home run beats Braves. Then we start the top of the ninth inning, and Billy Bruton hits me a ground ball, nice one-hopper. And back then, you could use first baseman mitt as big as sacks, you know, where they put the band across the back of them. So I caught the sucker and run over and stepped on the bag. The only thing is I'd caught the end of the mitt in my first baseman mitt, and the ball was laying back out in the infield. So they're sacrificing the second. Somebody scores them. They tie it up. We go about 12 innings before we beat them, and the headlines the next day said rookie's boner almost cost Giants game, you know. So you
made
really go from a hero to a goat.
But you still made the headlines. I remember those gloves. I played first base as a kid, and you couldn't feel the ball in them.
Lord, I had one so big I didn't have to bend over to make, you know, balls bounce over. I'd just stick that sucker down, and it'd flop in there somewhere, you know.
Well, in the interview that you sent me, and I remember when I was a kid, you had one fantastic day. Is that the most memorable game you had?
In the majors, and the funny thing was, I hadn't played in a month, you know. I'd been sitting on that bench. That afternoon, I went out to watch Oklahoma and Pittsburgh play football there. When Bud Wilkinson was coaching Oklahoma. And here they came out in those white uniforms with those cut-off white shoes. And my gosh, these suckers look like gazelles. That's the first time I'd ever seen it. Pittsburgh comes out, look like coal miners, and those big high-top football shoes, even the running backs, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Oklahoma just destroyed Pittsburgh that day. And I sit up there and ate four or five hot dogs and popping all this stuff, you know, because I know I wasn't going to play. Came down to the clubhouse there at Forbes Field and salted away a couple of sandwiches and a couple of chocolate milks and went out and set the first game. No, and then I went in between games, the same thing. Knowing I wasn't going to play. And Rigney comes over to me and he says, Harris, you're playing first base and hitting fourth. And I couldn't hardly wobble, you know, I'd eat the breakfast. But anyway, as luck would have it, I had a couple of singles, I guess single, double, something, and hit a couple of home runs and had seven more RBIs, you know. Then I come up the last time and Louis Arroyo's pitching, little left-handed jump baller. And the bases are loaded, and I say, hey, you know, I had a chance to do something here. And he hung me a curveball, and I hit that thing as hard as I've ever hit a ball in my life to dead center in Forbes Field, and it was a big center field in Forbes Field.
Long way up.
Burden goes back just as far as that sucker can go, and he dives on his belly and catches that thing. Or I'd have had at least three more RBIs and probably a triple, which 10 RBIs, 7 is not bad, but 10 would have been better. So that's probably the most memorable day. Now, the next day I went 0-3 against Bob Friend, and I was back on the bench.
It evens out, doesn't it?
My glory was short-lived. I sort of like that quarterback for the Houston Oilers, you know, that went in for the last week or so. He had that good week against Pittsburgh, and then last week it showed, you know.
5 out of 17 or something
right.
Like that, yeah.
So, at least I had one good day, and he had one good game we can talk about, I guess.
What did you think of Rigney as a manager?
Bill was a pretty good manager. I think the job overwhelmed him. You know, to be a major league manager, especially in New York, Jesus, you got so many forces you got to fight, you know. You
mm-hmm.
got the press nipping at you all the time, probably anywhere. And you got to be a pretty good PR man along with the other. And the job really, it got to Bill. Of course, he took over for Drosher. And while Drosher wasn't one of my favorite people, he nevertheless was a showman.
Mm-hmm.
You DeRoche used to go out and talk to umpires, and he wouldn't say anything. He'd throw towels and wave his hand and wouldn't say a word. And on the other hand, Paul Richards would come out of the dugout with one pants leg up over the knee and the other down, and what he'd call, he'd question those umpires' berth on about every sentence, you know, and looked like he was just passing the time of the day, you know. So I guess it's all in showmanship, you know.
Yeah. Well, DeRoche, I guess, was a showman.
Well, back in those days, they had some great showmen. They had Charlie Grimm up at Milwaukee and DeRoche and Fred Haney over at Pittsburgh. These guys were showmen, you know. Haney used to take that lineup card out to third base. He'd coach some. He'd bury that thing, you know, the other team, and he'd put hexes on it all through the game, you know. And Charlie Grimm was a great tenor banjo player. And I know we'd play in Milwaukee, and Eddie Peabody, who was one of the well-known tenor banjo players, he'd come up there, and after the game, get in that clubhouse and listen to those two guys play those tenor banjos, and it was really great, you know.
This brings up a question I wasn't going to ask, but it just occurred to me. Talking about managers like Grimm and DeRoche, a lot of people think these two men, especially these two, are Hall of Fame
They really are. You know, DeRoche, he would sell his mother into slavery to win a game or a pennant, but he was just a fierce, fierce competitor. You know, he came up in that, he played with the Gas House Gang, and then he was over there at New York, you know. Now, I hope you wouldn't say this, but I'll make reference to it, but they said he roomed there with Babe Ruth, you know. And, of course, Leo came up through the hustling pool to make a living, and then George Raft took him under his wing and taught him how to dress and all this stuff, you know. But they said one of Babe Ruth's World Series rings was missing there one morning when he got up, you know, and he didn't know where it was, but he told Leo, if that thing is not back here when I get back, he said, I'm going to wring your neck like a chicken, you know. And the ring came back. But anyway, see, Leo, we went out to Beverly Hills there. We used to go out each year from Phoenix and would play Cleveland some exhibition games out on the coast because they didn't have Major League Ball at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So Leo and Lorraine Day, they had a big home in Beverly Hills. They'd invite us over. And they had a fabulous home, but they'd just throw a tent over the backyard. And they had the ball, giant ball players, and they'd invite all the actors and actresses to this party. And it was a big show. But Leo one time, he showed us his, he pulled out a rack of nothing but sport coats out of his room, had 80-some sport coats on. Another rack had maybe 100 pair of slacks. Another place, he had at least 100 pair of shoes, and probably each pair cost $100. It was unbelievable. The guy, he was a clothes horse, you know.
Yeah.
But he came up with nothing, and all of a sudden he got something, and hey, he really lived it to the hilt.
Well, I guess if you got it, you got to flaunt it.
Well, you know, the interesting thing was Jeff Chandler, the old movie actor, he and I became great friends because they called me Cochise since I've got a little Cherokee Indian in me, and of course he made the movie Cochise. But he was a frustrated athlete. He really wanted to play Major League Ball. So he worked out with this one whole spring there in Phoenix, and we called ourselves the Scribinos, you know. So when we had the party out at Leo's, we presented him a trophy with the Jeff Chandler, the Scribino of the Year, 55. Anyway, the sucker broke down in tears. And we had all the Scribinos, right? Dusty Rhodes, Bobby Hoffman, all of us, you know. And he said, you know, I think if I had won an Oscar, that I would have appreciated this more.
Oh,
and that really was touching, you know.
I bet it was.
But
I
just remember that.
Is he still alive?
No, he died very young. He died probably soon after that, 4, 5, 6 years.
Now, I remember I always liked him as a kid, but I haven't seen anything. I guess, don't keep up with that, but
I
haven't seen him for years.
He was premature gray, but, he died young.
That's a shame. Okay, you went to the Tigers in 58, and you were very close to the team's offense.
K-Line had a bad year. He didn't have a real good year. And Keene, I guess Harvey led the league in hitting in 59.
Yeah.
But I led the league in home runs and RBIs. and had a pretty good year, you know. And then they fired a guy named Bill Norman, who was my, he was really my mentor. You know, he told me, he said, son, I'm going to put you out there every day, and you're going to play. He said, you go for 5-0-6, make a couple errors. He said, you're still going to play the next day. And it really made me feel great, you know. And I knew that if I come to the ballpark, if I really screwed up, I was still going to play. And then a guy named Jimmy Dykes came in, and that was the name of that team, you know. But
well, you didn't start the season as a regular first baseman, did you?
No, Ray Boone.
Yeah, and so you didn't really start playing until June.
No, I'd hit a couple of pinch hit home runs and started in June, and then I was hitting in there. Let's see, Kaline was hitting third, and I was hitting fourth, and Charlie Maxwell fifth. And really, I had a good enough year that they didn't want Kaline over 3 or 4 times to get to me, even when Ford was pitching, you know, Ford or some of the fairly good left-hander. So that made me feel pretty good, you know.
Yeah, I bet it did.
But, no, that's the one year that I would remember as having a pretty good year, you know.
Yeah, tremendous RBI percentage. You only had 400 and some odd at-bats, and had over 80 runs batted in.
Yeah.
Really, really good production.
Yeah, they set the table. You know,
yeah.
I laughed. We played the Yankees, and of course Ryan Duren, you know, he had the reputation of being blind, and he wasn't blind because I remember I was playing against him out at Denver when Houck was managing out there, and one of our players lost a contact lens at home plate, and Duren found it. But he had glasses looked like he had the Coke bottle.
I've seen his glasses, yeah.
And every time Kaline would come up there with nobody on, Duren would spread him. I mean, he'd deck him and hat one, sculler one way, bat the other way, and Kaline the other way. So Paul Foytak roomed with Kaline. And we're playing there in Tiger Stadium, and sure enough, Kaline comes up, and Jesus, Duren decks him. So Paul Foytak said, I'm going to stop that. So Duren comes up, and he's got that bat choked up about the trademark, and Foytak zips a couple fast strikes in there, and that 2-0 pitch, he hit him upside the head. And Duren went down like a stuck hog. You know, when you're not hurt too bad, you fall down on your hands. He fell right down on his nose.
Oh, boy.
Well, here I am playing first base, and out of that Yankee dugout, side by side, comes Eddie Robinson, Hank Bauer, and Mickey Mantle.
Oh, boy.
Hey, three big mothers.
Closest to you.
They're hitting right for me. You know, and of course, Bauer's that tough ex-Marine, you know.
Yeah.
And they got up there to me, and Bauer looked at me and said, if we liked that son of a bitch, said we'd probably start a fight. But they all hated him, and I was so thankful that they didn't like him, you know, because they'd have probably killed me.
Well, I understand that one of the reasons, I don't know what they're us, but he got the Yankees in a lot of fights simply for doing what he did.
Well, he came in there this series, and he had a black eye. And I asked one of the Yankee players, I said, where'd Duren get that black eye? And he said the major decked him. Of course, the major was Houck.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they clinched the pennant in Kansas. I don't know where it was. But anyway, they took a train into Detroit, and apparently they had a few drinks or something. Of course, I didn't know Duren was an alcoholic until later on. But
I understand he's really straightened up.
Huh?
I understand he's really straightened up.
Anyway, he got on the train, and he took Houck smoked those thin cigars, and he took the back of the major's head and pushed that cigar in the major's face.
Oh, boy.
And they said Houck got up at one punch, and he stretched Duren right out of that aisle way, boy.
Sounded like he was asking for it.
Well, Houck was, Houck was a Ranger during World War II, and he'd lost his wife, and they said he led those invasions on some of those islands wanting to get killed, you know. I've seen him in action. We got in a free-for-all with the Denver team, and he's a judo expert. And he went crazy. He didn't know who he was throwing, but he was throwing bodies everywhere.
Yeah, I understand he ran a pretty tight ship.
Well, they said that even one night he had taken his wife down there to Copacabana and two other couple to celebrate their anniversary, and Gordon McRae was appearing there. And McRae danced with the first woman, and he danced with the other, and he asked Houck's wife to dance, and Houck got up and decked Gordon.
Wow.
It said stretch McRae out right there on the dance floor of the Copacabana.
That's, But, a little overreactive.
He'd sit there and chew that spit up the back and throw those rocks out of the dugout for 9 innings and a little of pebbles. You know, that was his way. But he was a good manager.
What about him in the Hall of Fame?
As a manager, probably. See, his job with the Yankees during his playing career was to protect Rashie and Reynolds. They'd go out to drink. Hal could go with them. He would shepherd them. He would get the one back in the hotel that's pitching to take care of him. Same way with Hegan over at Cleveland. He took care of Lemon, Wynn, Garcia. They were all heavy drinkers, you know.
But Hegan played.
He played, but he also had to shepherd.
Yeah.
Shepherd those players because I've seen those suckers. I say they are heavy drinkers, but I've watched them in spring training. They'd put those rubber jackets on and get out there and run for 9 innings. My God, I thought they was going to die. But they're all winning 20 games.
Yeah, the work for them, don't knock it.
They had, Lemon, he was 24, 25 games about every year, you know. He just throw that little sinker in there and start at your knees, and time you swing, it'd be down at your ankles, you know, and you'd kill every worm in that infield. Now, didn't have overpowering stuff, but he had excellent control.
He was sure successful for about,
really,
what, 8 or 10 years.
He was a good hitter, you know. He came up as a third baseman.
Yeah, that was a fine pitching staff. Talking about pitchers, who was the best pitcher you saw in your time?
Well, the best right-hander really was the Bob Friend, probably. Best left-hander, I'd say, was Warren Spahn.
Just a couple two good pitchers to start the staff with.
Friend moved the ball around, changed speeds real well, and in Spahn, Jesus, he could put that thing in a teacup. Now, I didn't face, only time I faced Koufax was in 55 there with the Dodgers, and they just, back then, if you got over a $6,000-$7,000 bonus, you had to stay at the big club for 2 years.
Right.
So they had Koufax up there, and he should have been in the minors, but they'd put him in mop-ups and this stuff, and he couldn't get his curveball. It'd bounce about halfway between pitcher's mound and home plate. But I'm going to tell you one thing. I saw him at, I went over to the Tigers in 61, I believe. To the Dodgers. I went to Vero Beach. I believe it was 61. And I was watching him warm up. The Dodgers, they use strings, you know. They'll have two strings going down, vertical and two horizontal, and they'd have the little spaces in there for the pitchers to throw through, you know.
Yeah.
And he only had three pitches, fastball, curveball, and change. And I watched him throw for 30 minutes, and as God is my witness, he didn't miss that whole a time in 30 minutes. He could put every pitch he had into a teacup.
I lived out
probably,
in Southern.
Had I faced him later on, I would have said he would have been the greatest left-hander.
He was fantastic. I saw him as a kid.
Spahn was great, and he had the great move to first base. You know, you take one step off first base and blink your eye, and he picks you off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was that good. He was just a terrific competitor. So those two really stick out in my mind as the toughest that I had to hit.
Who was the best player you saw?
Best player I ever saw in my life was Willie Mays.
Mm-hmm.
All around.
I think that's a safe answer.
He could do it all.
Yes.
You know, we play in the Cubs, and Bob Rush has got a one-hitter. We go into the last of the ninth in the Polo Grounds. Mays walks to first, steals second. Stealing third, they throw the ball over third baseman's head, and he scores, and he's beat Rush 1-0.
Wow.
That's the kind of ball player he was.
Yeah. And I remember when I was 18, I was a pitcher at that time, and I was invited to – I lived out near San Francisco, and I was scouted, and they told me to come to Seal Stadium, which is their first year out there. And Bill Posdell would watch me throw, and I did, and they gave me a uniform to get on the uniform and go out there. I was in the locker room ready to go out, and as I went out, I passed Mays. And I'm about 4 or 5 inches taller than him and probably 25 pounds heavier. And I look at him, I say, geez, he doesn't look like much. And to myself, I didn't say this to him, obviously. But then I'd see him in a game, and I couldn't, you know, to me, he was not a particularly impressive-looking individual.
Well, the thing he had, though, he had little muscles on top of the big muscles. His body was so heavily muscled. Now, this is back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
That our trainer would have to get him on the rubbing table and loosen him up on all over the whole body before he could even play a game. And at night, he would get muscle cramps, and the trainer would have to go down and give him rub downs just to loosen him up, you know.
Well, I've been told he probably could have been a terrific boxer if he'd applied himself.
He was just – and the one thing about it, you know, they kept getting on him about why he didn't get more actively involved in the NAACP or the plight of the colored people. He said, listen, I am – Willie Mays ball player. I am doing more for my race by what I'm doing than anything you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the truth.
It is. Certainly it is. Okay, from your career, Gale, did you save souvenirs?
Not really. I've got a few pictures here on the wall. I had some pictures at an office, and half of them burned up. But I do have, I've just got a few pictures here of remembrances. You know, that's about all.
Do you get much fan mail today?
Probably 15, 20 letters a month.
And were they autograph requests mostly?
They sent pictures, the pictures for a request. And some people, they'll write letters, this and that. And I get some nice letters, you know. From people, it's funny, I get letters from kids now, and they say my grandfather said you were a pretty good mom. I mean, a lot of time marching on, you know. But every now and then I'll get just a beautiful letter from some fella that remembers back. And when baseball, when people played baseball for the love of the game.
And not for the three-year, $5 million contract.
I know some of those ball players that have probably played for nothing. In fact, we did play for nothing.
Yeah.
But the game has changed. Not saying the game back then was better than now, because you've got some good athletes now. But you had more stars back when I played. You had five or six stars on each ball club, and the reason you did, you had eight teams in each league. You know, by going to 12 teams in each league, you've given 100 more ball players a chance to play major league ball.
That would never have been there.
Had never been there. I remember the Dodger team. You know, if he was a shortstop in the Dodger chain with Peavy there, or a first baseman with Hodges, or a catcher with Campanella, you died. I know Billy Hunter and Chico Carrasquel and a lot of these people, Don Zimmer, they were stuck in that Dodger organization and couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm. What you say the change? What is the biggest change? I think it's the expansion that's been the biggest change.
Well, I think the talent really has been watered down by all the expansion. The ballparks are the game has changed. AstroTurf has changed the game. You know, you're looking for all this speed and that. And the thing that always amazed me about the Dodgers, they were always looking for speed. And in their minor league camp, they had all these tracks that put these speed demons on, 100-yard dash and all this. And they've never had over two people could run their whole history of the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
Maury Wills is the only one I remember could run. Well, Sachs could run some, but yeah, you take back the Dodger teams in the 50s. Now, Robertson could steal some bases, maybe Gilliam a few, but that's about it, you know.
And they wouldn't steal them except when it was important.
Oh, yeah, well, you didn't need to steal in Ebbets Field, my God, with that murderous road they had coming
yeah.
up there.
That's
Snyder sat right in there. A left-hand hitter was the only left-hand hitter in the lineup, so he never saw a left-hand pitcher. I don't think Spahn ever won a game in the Ebbets Field.
And hit 40 home runs year after year after year.
You got Campy and Hodges and Ferrillo and all that, Robinson and all that crew coming up there. Right-hand hitters, the left-hand hitters, paradise.
You know? Put in Spahn or Simmons or somebody like that, and it's murder.
They couldn't make it there.
You retired. You left the game at the age of 28, I believe. Is
well,
that right?
I went back to the minors. Dodgers traded me to, the Tigers traded me to the Dodgers. And I went out to St. Paul and had a decent year. And then the next year, team moved into Twin Cities, a major league team, so they moved to Omaha. And I was playing out there, and the Cubs were following me and were going to pick me up. And that would have given me that other half year I needed. I had 4.5 years in the majors, and then where they didn't make it retroactive back when they changed it to 4 for the old-timer, so I'd have gotten my 5 years in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And were getting ready to sign me, and I got beamed. A big left-hander named Ron Nishwich pitching for Denver, and Mike Rourke, the pitching coach over with the Cardinals, told me, the guy before me had all money, he said, now you better be loose, that he's probably going to deck you. And that sculler, he threw the ball inside, my sculler flew up and hit me upside the head, and I had a concussion, double vision, blood in my spinal fluid.
Mm.
So I was laying there, I swallowed a chew of tobacco, you know, wasn't feeling too good. And I told the good Lord, if you'll just let me get through this, I won't do this anymore. And he did, and I didn't. But the crazy thing was, Then I kept getting letters all winter. Got a letter from the Syracuse Ball Club and all this. So I didn't even open the darn letter. And so the thing that happened is that I found out that I'd been sold to Syracuse, and they had invited me to spring training with the Mets. That was back when Thornberry. And had I opened the darn letter, I could probably gone back and got another half year. But I didn't open the letter till the next summer, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just as well.
Well, any regrets?
No. I don't have any regrets.
Not
a mediocre ball player. I had an opportunity. Probably the greatest thrill I got out of all the time I was in the majors is just being able to play in both leagues. I mean, I saw some great ball players. You know, I saw the Musials and the Mantles and the Marises. Gosh, I remember one Sunday there in Sportsman's Park there in St. Louis. Musial hit 3 home runs the first game off of Antonelli and hit 2 off of John McCall the second game. 5 home runs off a left-hand pitch.
I remember that.
And I said, my God.